welcome to Tales from the South.
Out my door, the leaves are falling. Cold, wild wind will come. Sweethearts walk by together.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music about the Salty Dogs? Do y'all like the Salty Dogs? Arkansas's premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, have 3 full-length albums, and their music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces and HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, our Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Ruth Coker Burks was a young mother in her 20s when the AIDS epidemic hit Arkansas in the early 1980s. Despite having no medical training, she took it upon herself to care for AIDS patients who were abandoned by their families and even by medical professionals who feared the disease. Coker Burks, now 55, estimates that she has cared for nearly 1,000 people over the past 3 decades. From her life's mission to selflessly take care of AIDS patients, the attention she received led to her becoming the executive director of HPWA, Helping People with AIDS, then was asked by the President of the United States of America to be only one of 12 international delegates to the first White House conference on HIV/AIDS. Lovingly known as the Cemetery Angel and Saint Ruth, Ruth Coker Burks has been featured in regional, national, and international publications and shows, including the Arkansas Times, StoryCorps, the BBC, and NPR's Morning Edition. Originally from Hot Springs, Arkansas, Ruth now lives in Northwest Arkansas with her family. Tonight, Ruth takes us back to the 80s and fear, courage, and love in Remembering. Ladies and gentlemen, Ruth Coker Burks.
I appreciate y'all having me tonight, and I'm still recovering from a stroke I had 5 years ago, so if I get lost, just kind of bring me back to where I was and excuse if I get hung up on something. This is the first time I've spoken in public since. It was 1983, and I had been visiting with a friend on the cancer floor at the University of Arkansas Medical Center. When I noticed one of the rooms had a big red bag taped to the door that said, "Warning, contagious." I noticed that the nurses would draw straws to see which one of them would have to go back in and check on the patient. Best 2 out of 3. I have a cousin who lived in Hawaii. He's still alive, but I was really worried about AIDS in the early days, and I was worried about him, so I learned everything I possibly could about this disease. And back then, it wasn't even called AIDS, and it hadn't even been named GRID yet, gay-related immune deficiency. So I was really interested and curious about everything. And as I had suspected, this patient had AIDS. No one would go in his room, not a nurse, not a friend, not a family member, no one. His food tray sat in a line outside the door in the hallway to be trampled by all. So what did I do? I snuck into his room to see what I could do for him. I stood at the foot of his bed and I asked him his name, Jimmy. And he told me that he wanted his mama. He was so very weak that I could barely hear him. I was concerned about AIDS, but I didn't let on. I told him I would get his mother for him. That was simple enough. He drifted off to sleep, so I marched right up to the nurse's station and announced that he wanted his mama. They scolded me at first for going into the room, and then they all laughed. They said, he's been up here for 6 weeks. His mama's not coming. Nobody's coming up here. And was I crazy? The nurses reminded me that I was taking a huge risk going in there and that I was on my own. So I walked right back into that room, and when I did, he looked up at me, and he held out his hand, and he said, oh, mama, I knew you'd come. At that moment, panic rushed over my body, but all of a sudden, calm spread over me, and I stayed. What else could I do? My mind raced for an answer. He was so dehydrated that all he could muster was one tear. And I was stuck. What in the world had I gotten myself into? And I asked God for help and for strength. I reached out my ungloved hand and I took his hand in mine, and he started to cry. And I stayed there as quiet as a mouse glued to the floor. He sobbed more as I stood there, and I was afraid to even breathe. He still had no tears, but I started to cry for him. I stayed with him for 13 hours while he died. I knew that that was what God was asking me to do. And I waited and I watched a man die for the second time in my life. The first one was my daddy. When I was only 5 years old, Daddy died on Thanksgiving Day, 1964, at home with just me and my mother. So many years later, I vowed right then and there that no one with AIDS would ever die alone if I had anything to do with it. And I kept my word. Not one single nurse came in while I was there. I guess they were relieved that they didn't need to check on him anymore. All he needed was for me to sit there with him while he quietly slipped away. He didn't want to die alone, but who would? The nurses asked me what funeral home. Well, how was I supposed to know that? I asked for his mother's phone number, and they gave it to me. When I called his mother, she answered the phone, and I told her who I was and that I was calling about her son, and she hung up on me. So I called back, and I told her that if she hung up on me again, I would put his obituary in the hometown newspaper, and I would list his cause of death. I had her full attention. Little did I know that she didn't care. I told her that if she didn't care what happened to her son, I certainly did. And she told me that she didn't care who I sent him to, and that she didn't even want his ashes back to bury them. To her, her son had been dead for years. She hung up the phone, and I didn't know what to say. I also didn't know that throughout the next 15 to 20 years, I would have the same conversation over and over again. I called every funeral home in the state of Arkansas, and no one would take him. I finally got a hold of a black mortuary in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. They said that they would only cremate him. I didn't have the money to spend on a cremation. The hospital had a fund that paid for indigent cremations. I had to call his mother one more time for permission to cremate. She gave it and told me to do whatever I wanted with his ashes. The funeral directors came in those horrible moon suits. They looked like they were from outer space. They put him in a bag and carried him off without one shred of dignity. They came after hours and left out the back door. It was all a big secret, and Jimmy's room was closed off for many days. No one knew what to do. I tried to get back to normal as best I could, and weeks later, a box of ashes came in the mail. Again, I didn't know what to do. So I got a donated cookie jar from a local potter, and I dug the grave, and I buried him on top of my daddy's grave so that no one would know what I was doing. And I would remember where Jimmy was. If word had gotten out that I had buried an AIDS patient, much less taken care of one, there was not a judge in the state of Arkansas, or in America for that matter, who would not have taken my daughter away from me and given full custody to her father, and I knew it. I was back to being scared. So now word got out that there was this crazy lady in Hot Springs who wasn't afraid of AIDS patients, and the calls started coming in. I had promised God that if he didn't let me die from AIDS, I would take care of him. I would take care of them. I hadn't said anything about the rest. Call after call after call came in, and they were all frantically asking for help. They were dying, and they needed help. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know of a doctor who would see them. I didn't know of medicine to help. But I would listen to their sobbing phone calls in the middle of the night. I would pray with them over the phone. Friends would call about friends. Patients would call about themselves. And mothers would call about a friend of a friend of a friend. And the more friends they would put in the middle, the more I knew it was about them. I will try and see what I can do, I told them. I was overwhelmed. I was still scared. I prayed and asked God for guidance, and I asked God, why me? And God answered, why not you? He has a way about himself. After a while, I found a doctor who would see them after hours and in through the back door. Not a word was to be spoken about what was going on, or they would quit. The story was the same for the next few years. Person after person would be rushed to the emergency room in a life-threatening state, and they would die very shortly from AIDS. I knew every one of them. The hospitals would call me in a panic to get them out of their hospital. I didn't know if it was because they were gay or because they have AIDS. Back then, it didn't matter. Hospice asked me if I was kidding. Take an AIDS patient? Was I crazy? Fear and panic were rampant. I finally found a pharmacy who would order their medicine, but I would have to pick it up, and who was going to pay? So I called then-Governor Bill Clinton asking for funds to pay for medicine, and he said yes without hesitation. Then came Christmas of 1986. My four-year-old daughter, Allison, and I were on our way to a house in Little Rock, Arkansas, where five AIDS patients had moved in together to try to take care of each other. All of their friends and family had abandoned them. Rumors were rampant, including that you could catch AIDS from just being in the same room with someone, much less touching something they had touched. The week before, I had asked for donations for these AIDS patients last Christmas. A Christmas tree from a tree farmer, Christmas cards from a Hallmark shop, stamps from a realtor, little things that I knew would make a big difference. As we drove to the AIDS house, I told Allison that she could not tell anyone what we had done or who we saw or what they had. And I felt so guilty. For one, I was taking my only child, my baby, to a house where I knew people were dying from AIDS. And two, I was teaching my daughter to be kind, loving, and giving, and asking her at the same time to keep a secret, a big secret. How could I teach my daughter all of this good and at the same time tell her it was a bad thing to tell anyone? We arrived at the house with a big surprise for everyone, Christmas. We unloaded the tree and all the trimmings, and everyone cried. We all knew it would be their last Christmas, and they knew that no one else cared. They were wrong. I cared, and my daughter cared, even though she was only 4 years old. Then came the moment of truth, which I will never forget. Someone offered my daughter a glass of Coke. Would I let my daughter drink out of that glass? I had been preaching that AIDS could not be spread by touching anything that an AIDS patient had touched, and it was safe to drink out of a glass that an AIDS patient had used and washed, that soap would kill the virus. but now it was my time to put up or shut up. My daughter looked at me, and I looked at her, and the glass was in her hands. And what could I do? I told the guys my fears for my baby. I could do it, but could I let her drink out of that same glass? They all understood. They really did. My honesty just came out, and we talked about the fears and living with AIDS. Then my daughter took the glass, and she drank from it. We all cried. That one barrier had been broken, and it was a big one, and we knew it. Over the next 25 years or so, I would care for over 1,000 men and women while they were dying from AIDS. I would witness incredible acts of bravery and unbelievable acts of abandonment. I would hold hands and hug and give them whatever one needs more than anything else in the world, love. And I would bury over 40 in cookie jars as makeshift urns in my family cemetery, just me and my daughter saying a prayer as we put them on earth. Those were incredibly difficult times, there's no question. But when I think of those years, what I remember most are the days like that sunny Sunday afternoon in December 1986, when one of the young men taught my daughter how to paint using watercolors, and another taught her how to make ornaments for Christmas out of construction paper and glitter. And even though 2 weeks later both of those men were dead, on that day, all of those brave and generous men taught us the real meaning of love, faith, and the true meaning of Christmas. And for that, I am eternally blessed.
So thank you so much, Ruth Coker Burks, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Your story starts off in 1983 at the Med Center in Little Rock with Jimmy as he died. Do you remember, and at that point you knew what the caution signs were on the door, or you thought you knew what they were, and it turned out to be correct.
Right.
Do you remember the very first time you heard of AIDS, and is there a story behind that? What was that like?
Well, I have a cousin in Hawaii who's gay, and we didn't know him, but my grandmother had little tiny school pictures, and every night we would go in and take each picture down and pray for them and put them back up, and it was just a ritual we did every night. So I loved him before I ever met him. And I was concerned about his health, and it was so new that when I went to Hawaii and I told him that I was concerned, he said, oh, no, that's just something the leather guys in San Francisco have, because it was so rare back then. And they get it in the bathhouses, and don't worry about me, I'm fine. And I didn't know that his friend Kane had AIDS, and I don't think he did either.
And so so Kane didn't know, or Raymond, or both?
Raymond didn't know that Kane had AIDS.
I see.
And I don't know if Kane even knew he had AIDS, because back then, you know, you didn't know until you showed up in the emergency room and you were within, you know, days of dying.
And so so that was the very first person that you knew of?
Yes, but I didn't know it then. I didn't know it until... He kept, you know, he would call and I would talk to Kane. We just became close friends. And he would call, and I remember the last time I talked to him. And then he called back about a week later, and it took me a few days to get back to him. And when I did, his mother told me that he had died. And he never told me that he had AIDS. So I don't know if he even knew back then. Mm-hmm.
You talk about a potter donating chipped cookie jars to use as urns. So the first one was Jimmy, correct?
Yes, yes.
So what was it like when you first approached this potter? Can you tell us the story of actually that happening, and how did that happen?
Well, I didn't know what to do. And I had these ashes, and they come in a post office box, you know, like a box from the post office. And so anyway, they delivered them to me. And that was the first time I'd ever seen ashes before. And I didn't know what to do, and I looked around my house to see what I had that I could put them in, and, you know, just what you normally do. I don't know what you normally do when you get ashes in the mail, but that's what I did. And so there's a Dryden Pottery, which is a big pottery place in Hot Springs, and I thought, well, you know, I'll try. So I put a pretty bow in Allison's hair and, you know, fixed her up real cute and nice because I really needed a donation because I was so broke and so poor back then. And I went in and I asked Kimbo, who's a little bit older than I am, but not that much, if he had any chipped or broken cookie jars, because, and I told him that what I was going to do, and I had the ashes under my arm, because I, you know, I kind of wanted him to be under a little bit of stress to, you know, here, give her this and, you know, get her out of here. And so he gave me a cookie jar. And I didn't know that I would ever need another cookie jar, but I thought, well, you know, that's very nice, and wrote him a nice little thank you. And, you know, I have sent those cookie jars all over the world because there were people all over the world who, you know, didn't have any money. Back then, there was no money for AIDS, none. And there was no one around, and there was no one to help. So I had to send them out all over the United States, and Kimbo was, you know, glad to get rid of them because they wouldn't sell. And that's how I started burying them in cookie jars. And I would take them and seal the top, and then we would go out, my daughter and I, and I would dig, and she had a little trowel, and she would dig, and, you know, had her pacifier in her mouth and all that, and we were out digging a grave. And then later on, she went to Catholic school, and she learned some prayers, and she had her little prayer book, and she would say little prayers, because I could not find a preacher in the state of Arkansas who would go and say a kind word over a person's grave. I couldn't get anyone to come and see them while they were living, but I thought, surely they'll come and say something nice. I couldn't get my pastor. No one would do it.
And so you buried Jimmy there actually with your dad, correct?
I did.
And so this is a family plot on your family land?
It's a cemetery, and there's a story behind that. My mother got mad at her oldest brother when I was 10 years old, and she bought 286 grave spaces in the family cemetery so he and his family couldn't be buried with the rest of us. And every Sunday we would go out, and she would look, and she'd say, "Someday all of this is going to be yours." And I always wondered what I would do with the cemetery. And she even had her marker put up, and it said, "Woe be unto ye, hypocrites, Pharisees, and scribes." And later she took it down and put up a normal marker. But I had all those grave spaces, and who would ever imagine that there would come a time when parents did not want their children to bury them? So I've buried over 40, I think 43 people in the family cemetery, and I started by burying them on top of my daddy's grave and my grandma, so I would know where they were and they wouldn't be disturbed. And I lived in fear that somebody would find out what I was doing. And I lived in fear that somebody would go up, dig them up, and throw them out in the middle of the street. But that never happened.
So they're still there.
They're still there. And the funeral homes later on decided, well, we need to do something legal about this. So I had to sign a piece of paper saying that if the family ever came, that I would give the ashes back. And I would have them in, you know, where they could find them and all that. But no one ever came.
So in all these years, no one's ever
come? No one has ever come.
Well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, You indicated that you had done research on AIDS at the time. What source did you use at the time?
I used anything I could find. There wasn't much. We didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have anything. So any magazine, I told everybody, if you get an article, if you find a magazine, and, you know, the second something would be on TV, I'd be dashing to it just to see what it was.
I remember that everyone was scared with AIDS. We'd heard that you could catch it for all kinds of ways. And we realize now that it can only be caught, you know, one way.
Right.
Yes. So I applaud you. I tell you, it is, because you were stepping out. Because a lot of doctors or medical personnel didn't do that.
I didn't have a doctor that would see them. I didn't have a nurse, not one nurse. I was their hospice. I was their nurse. I was their caregiver. I was their everything for many years. It wasn't until about 1989 that I could even get a doctor to see him, and he was my personal physician, and he would see him if I brought him in after hours and through the back door and if word ever got out. But I had a former IV drug user as a patient, and he just liked the feel of the needle, and so he let me practice starting IVs and drawing blood. And so that's how I started. And I could take the blood in, and they would test it, but they didn't know what to do. If they, you know, whatever they found. So I would call a friend in Washington, D.C., and I go, what do they have you on? What are your symptoms? And that's how we did it back then.
First of all, what an incredible woman you are. I think everybody here is just amazed at your courage and
thank
your heart.
You.
So
thank you
so much for that.
Thank you.
I'm very curious about what your daughter is now doing.
My daughter lives in Fayetteville, and she has my three grandchildren who are wonderful. And AIDS didn't affect her at all. When all this came up in NPR, I asked her, and she said, no, it didn't affect her. You know, it can't not affect you, but it didn't devastatingly affect her.
Well, you made a positive influence, I'm sure, on her.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Very inspiring story. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Great, amazing courage. Obviously, the mentality of the majority of the population was not in line with what you were doing or thinking or the way you were acting.
No.
Even now, there's still stigma attached to AIDS
Absolutely.
And HIV, and we're just, you know, starting to talk about it in the most respectful ways possible. But I'm curious, just from what you've lived, what do you think that we as a society can learn from your story?
Oh, thank you. That was a good question. You know, I don't know. I had, in that interview with NPR, he asked me, what was I thinking when I stepped into that room? And I really wasn't thinking. I just went in. I knew I had to be on the other side of that red door. And I knew what I was doing meant something to the patient. I didn't care what, you know, my church and I'm Methodist, so we don't have enough religion to offend anyone. And they were offended. They, you know, and in society, I mean, I was really kind of an outcast in Hot Springs. You know, I didn't get invited to the parties, and whoever got to Sunday school first made the coffee, and then they'd say, oh, the coffee's good. Who made it? I go, oh, I did. And then a little while later, I noticed all the cups were sitting around still full of coffee because they didn't want to drink it because I had made it. And I think that, you know, and people have asked me about gay marriage, and I have stood in the shower with men holding their partners up so that we could bathe them, and then carrying them like babies back to the bed and drying them and putting powder on them and lotion and dressing them. And most of those men knew that their fate was the same thing, that they would soon die of AIDS. And if that's not love and devotion, I don't know what is. I don't.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Ruth Coker Burks, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience here at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. Additional support provided by UALR School of Mass Communications, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Just yesterday, I held your tender hand. Finally told me that I'm the only one. Well, it's hard to trust you after all these years, 'cause you've been known to break my heart before. To hear your voice makes me start to shiver. To see your smile, it almost makes me cry. There's a part of me that says you're not worth the effort. The other part wants your heart for. It's time.